This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
America's education divide. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The effort to reduce the distinct gap between the skills taught in schools and those required for success in the evolving workforce.
On the tech front, the newest threat to our privacy and security.
On the travel front, why a handful of beach towns are cracking down on tents.
And the battle in the state of Maine over those small liquor bottles, like the ones you'd find on an airplane.
These have become very popular on land, so this has led to a new problem, which is mini bottle litter. Lots of these little bottles on the roadsides, so forth. So people have become upset about that.
Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz on the debate over mini liquor bottles. She's here later in the hour. Well, across the nation, policymakers are confronting a distinct gap between the skills taught in schools and those required for success in the evolving workplace. Education has become a dividing line in America, one that separates those who are more likely to live prosperous lives from those who are more likely headed to a lifetime of struggle. Part of a series of stories at The Hill. Here's national correspondent Reed Wilson. Reed, what have you looked at?
Well, we have taken a look in this Changing America series at the underlying demographic, economic, and political changes going on in the country. And one of the things that's really leapt out at me is just the difference in the life experience between somebody who has gone to college and somebody who does not have a college degree. And that life experience extends to everything from how much money they're likely to make to their health and whether or not they use tobacco, whether or not they abuse drugs. The difference between what a well-educated American and a not-educated American goes through in their lives just cannot be starker.
Well, I was surprised, too. I don't know, like midway through the piece, you talked about mortality rates and folks, but generally speaking, with just, say, a high school degree or less, like or die 30% earlier or something?
Yeah, this is a study that's come out of Princeton. Two Princeton economists, Ann Case and Angus Deaton, have written about rising mortality rates, especially among non-college-educated white Americans between the ages of about 35 and 55. And really what they found is this is a clear indication that the opioid epidemic that is just ravaging America is actually reducing our lifespan. It's killing so many people that it's reducing the median age in this country. And it's one of these massive things that is being talked about a lot in Washington and in states across the country, but I still feel like it just cannot get enough attention given the scale of the crisis out there.
Yeah, that's amazing. Circle back to kind of the education aspect of this, and because you opened the story talking about the new mayor in Sacramento and what he's trying to accomplish. Explain that.
Yeah, so there are a number of cities across the country, and I was just talking to the mayor of Sacramento, so I figured I'd spotlight him, that are trying to build more paid internship programs. Let me be clear here. The idea that you need a college education to be successful in life is not as clear-cut as that. An emerging trend that we're seeing a lot of policymakers pursue are things like vocational colleges and vocational schools that train you for high-tech manufacturing jobs. The fact is there are fewer and fewer low-skill manufacturing jobs, you know, on an assembly line or something like that. Most of the manufacturing jobs in America today require knowledge of computers and computer coding and things like that. And that's what people like Daryl Steinberg, the mayor of Sacramento, and a number of other governors, senators, legislators across the country are trying to do. They're trying to create the basis for that sort of high-tech manufacturing education, because a lot of people think that the high school education that most Americans get is not sufficient to survive in the modern economy. So,
speaking with Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. He's written a piece entitled Changing America. It's part of the series, America's Growing Education Divide. So as you point out, more Americans than ever are going to college, which of course is leading to more debt when they graduate or quit. How does that factor into all this?
Yeah, this is the fascinating part. So the cost of colleges is massively exploding. I talked to one labor economist who told me that the average person who graduated in the 1990s would graduate college with about $10,000 in today's dollars in student debt. Today, the average American graduating from college ends with about $35,000 in debt. Now, that sounds crazy, but that is actually debt that's worth it. The median income for somebody who graduates from college somebody who's between about 25 and 29 years old today, is about $50,000 a year. The average income for somebody who hasn't graduated for college is about $30,000 a year. And that gap, that disparity between those who have graduated and those who haven't graduated, is wider than it's been in any previous generation since we've started collecting these types of statistics. You know, it's wider than it was for the boomers. It's wider than it was for Gen Xers. And what that really tells you is that the kinds of jobs that are available to non-college educated Americans are shrinking, or they're becoming they're not paying as well as they used to.
How much of a struggle is it right now to kind of get ramped up with these paid internships or better equipped vocational schools?
Yeah, this is one of the things that people are tackling all over the country. We've even heard some of this coming out of the White House. They're looking at apprenticeship-type programs, like something like what European countries like Switzerland and Germany do, programs that allow somebody to work in a field for a couple of years and then transition into a more full-time, higher-paying job over the long run. I really think this is the next big education challenge that our policymakers at the state and federal level are going to tackle.
Thanks, Reed. Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Thanks for being with us. Might soon see some graying of the temples more and more on the professional tennis circuit. For the first time in the game's modern era, the top five players in the world and the top five seeds recently at Wimbledon are over 30 years old. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
In tennis, 30-something is the new 20-something. For the first time in the game's modern era, the top men's players in the world are over 30. How did this happen? Matthew Futterman of the Wall Street Journal is here to explain how geezers have taken over. Matthew, is Roger Federer the oldest and best of this group?
Well, you'd have to say right now he's among the best of this over 30 group. It sort of changes from tournament to tournament, but he's had an incredible year. He won the Australian Open, and then won at Indian Wells, which is a huge tour stop, and also in Miami, which is another huge tour stop. So, 35 years old and going pretty strong.
And what are the other players in this group?
Well, Rafael Nadal, who is 31 and has been Federer's sort of chief rival for a while now, and Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray both just recently turned 30 this year. And in addition, and those four have been known as the big four for a while now. And they were joined a couple of years ago by Stan Wawrinka, who is like Federer's Swiss and in his early 30s and sort of had a late career blossoming when he got him to about that when he was 29, he really got himself into peak physical condition, and it sort of brought his game to another level that I don't think anyone thought was going to happen. And he has held his form together for the past three years, and has won a few Grand Slam tournaments. And those five are about as formidable a generation of players as we've seen.
Matthew, what are some of the theories of why this is happening?
Well, I think, the first thing is fitness and nutrition and rest. I mean, we know so much more now about how important it is as these elite athletes age for them to get their rest. So that's a huge factor, and also how to eat right and how to condition, how to be in peak form at the most important moments. The other thing is that I think is essential is that the money on the professional tennis tour has just boomed in the last 10 years, and whereas a decade ago, 20 years ago, when guys would hit their late 20s and start to struggle a little bit, it really wasn't worth it for them to sort of hang around the tour for a while, because that wasn't very lucrative to be the 25th ranked player in the world, because it's not just these top five players that are over 30 and doing well. Half of the top 32 players at Wimbledon that starts on Monday they are all over 30, which is crazy. And a lot of what happened is, they're not as physically talented, but they're as smart as the top players in terms of rest and nutrition and treatment, and they can make a fair amount of money doing what they do, even just in prize money. So they're hanging around the tour longer.
We're speaking with Matthew Futterman of the Wall Street Journal. And Matthew, with that extra prize money, gives the players the ability to kind of build the entourages that travel with them and keep them healthy, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, if you're a top player, you're traveling with a nutritionist, a coach, a trainer, a physio, physiotherapist, a masseuse. You have a whole team of people who are working towards the betterment of your game. And, if you're the 20th ranked player in the world, you probably don't have as large a team, but you're getting that guidance and you have a handful of people, and, maybe you're sharing a trainer with somebody else who's on the tour. You're getting a lot of knowledge and a lot of personal service that just wasn't there 20 years ago.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal sports writer Matthew Futterman. It's 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business. Michigan, contact michiganbusiness.org today. Well, a recent survey by special interest travel site bookyogaretreats.com has identified solo travel as a top trend for this year. Roughly half the respondents said that they would take their next vacation on their own. If the same is true of the population at large, it would make the solo travel market a niche that the industry can't ignore. But consumer advocate Chris Elliott says it doesn't seem to be that way. Chris, what's going on?
So here's what's going on. Most room rates, rates for cruise industry, for cruise cabins, are based on double occupancy. So if you're being quoted a rate, it means that you're staying with another person. So if you're staying as a single, that means that they're going to double your rate, which seems extremely unfair to the person who is traveling, because, you're paying essentially double what the other people are paying who are staying with traveling with their significant other or with a friend.
Yeah.
So what's happened is that the travel industry has said, hey, we're going to be solo friendly, and they've reduced some of the rates. So they've allowed people to maybe pay, instead of paying twice the rate, it's only 75% or 60% of the value of a ticket, which is a solo friendly action. Or they've created single rooms. This is especially true for cruise lines. They've created single berths.
Really?
And those, of course, are priced just for the single, so there's no double occupancy required. And there are also some tour operators that specialize in solo tours, but of course, what they'll do is match you up with another person, and if you don't get along with people, then you're kind of out of luck.
Right. So are hotels actually building single rooms as well?
Well, if you go to Europe, you'll find that there are hotel rooms that are for singles. They have just a single bed. And that room rates sometimes are based on solo occupancy, and then doubled if you're traveling with two people. So it gets a little bit confusing. Mm. But yes, there are single rooms out there. There, I didn't find any U.S. properties that were actively marketing single rooms, but I do know that they exist.
Mm. Why is it, by the way, that we seem to have more solo travelers right now, if I understood your story correctly?
Well, it's a growing market, and for a number of different reasons. I think that people are, people retire and they maybe travel with their spouse, and then maybe their spouse passes away, and they say, I don't want to, you know, just stay home. I want to keep going. So I actually talk to a lot of people like that, where, or even wives who have husbands who want to stay home and, you know, work on the car or whatever, and they want to go out and take a cruise or go on a tour. So that's part of the reason for the growth. But another part of the reason is just that there are more single people out there, and so they want to travel too.
Wow, I didn't think about that. Yeah. We're speaking with consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. He's written a piece entitled, The Travel Industry is Finally Ending Discrimination Against Solo Travelers. Or is it? He says there's still some discrimination out there. So if you're solo then and going to travel solo, how do you negotiate on your behalf? Is everything worthy of a negotiation question to say, a tour operator or a cruise ship or a hotel or an airline or something?
Yeah, well, airlines always charge based on just one seat. There aren't any double occupancy. Not yet. They haven't come up with that yet, but they may. Who knows? If it makes the money, you never know. You know, negotiating is a good idea. I think that you really want to make sure, you know, this situation happens a lot where people are they have a cruise that they're going to go on, and they find that the person that they were going to go on the cruise with doesn't want to go or can't go because they get sick. So they say, okay, I'll travel, I'll, you know, stay in the cabin, and then they find their rates going up. But when that happens, you really do have a very good case, and you can usually talk to the cruise line and get them to adjust the fare. But that's the one thing you got to really look out for. And then if you are planning on traveling solo, go for one of these tour operators. I mentioned them in the story that. Specialize in solo tours. Maybe they can match you up with someone, or maybe they can find a really good rate for you as a solo traveler. But definitely do your research. Don't allow yourself to be taken in by this discriminatory action by the travel industry, where they're basically doubling your room rate.
Ouch. Thanks, Chris. That's consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the newest threats to our privacy and security. The debate in the state of Maine over mini liquor bottles. And the new crackdown on East Coast beaches. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, do you want to create generational wealth for your family? Well, then run it like a business. That's the advice from Douglas Aze, wealth strategist and author of a book called Creating Generational Wealth. He's based in Maryland. Douglas, what's the message?
Yeah, we're just trying to make sure people know the proper way to pass the legacy onto their children and things that you need to have in place if you're a business owner or if you're a family that want to leave inheritance for your kids.
All right, so what's step one here?
Well, step one is going to be, you know, making sure you're properly structured and treating your family like a business and having the proper tools, like making sure you have the right type of trust in place and the right types of insurance and your business. If you're a business owner, how your business is properly structured to make sure that when you want your kids to transition and take over your company, you know, they're not stuck with paying a huge amount of taxes.
That's a tough conversation, though, for a lot of business owners and families, isn't it?
It is, big time. I mean, because, you know, we always have the Uncle Sam as our business partner that we did not solicit to come become our partners.
Right.
So he's always waiting around. So there's ways to properly structure your business, just like the wealthy families do, you know, and keep business from one generation to the other. So we practice the conversation that J.D. Rockefeller started, which is own nothing, control everything concept.
So how do you apply that to your family? Because I know you say run your family like you would a business, meaning what?
Yeah, because, you know, the president, I always say the president and the vice president and the husband and the wife and the children and the employees, and you want to make sure that you all have those family conversations. Like what I do in my family is I make sure all my kids understand the roles that they play. And we have you have your attorney in place, you have your accountants in place, and, you know, because the family brings in income just like every business, and we have bills just like every business. Mm. So we need to always talk about what we need to do to make sure that everything continues to run smoothly if anything should happen to any one of the family members.
Yeah. We're speaking with Douglas Aze, wealth strategist, also author of a book called Creating Generational Wealth, What the Super Wealthy Know That You Need to Know. Does the strategy shift over time as we get older?
Yes, definitely it has to, because you want to make sure that as you get older and as your income grows, you start looking at ways to minimize the amount of taxes that you pay out. You know, and then we start introducing stuff like private family foundations to our clients to make sure that, you know, they give, you know, like I said to all people, I said, my clients make a lot of money giving away money.
How so? What do you mean? To the government? by taxes, you mean?
Yeah, basically, by setting up and having the right type of foundations and nonprofit in place to make sure that, you know, they're able to pass wealth away, but at the same time control the wealth inside their foundations.
Very good. Give me another piece of wisdom from the book that you'd like to share.
Yeah, something about, you know, we always talk about life insurance is a key that a lot of us have been, you know, misled on. Life insurance, especially the cash value one, is something that every business owner should have in the aspect of using it as a way to create their own bank. Because a lot of business owners depend on the traditional bank for capital for their business. But unfortunately, when you go back to that bank to loan money, they put you through the ringer.
Yeah.
They want you to, you know, prove income and show them credit and all that. But one thing that hasn't been preached in the media is the importance of life insurance, how life insurance, cash value life insurance can actually come in place to help you start a business or even fund your business. And in the book, I share how I used my life insurance contract to start a medical practice in Maryland.
Wow.
And by borrowing money against my life insurance policy to fund a clinic and 100% debt-free.
Thanks, Douglas. Douglas Aze, wealth strategist and author of Creating Generational Wealth. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. No matter what we do to protect our digital privacy, it's your prerogative, especially on our handheld devices, it's impossible to keep up with new threats. Now, there's a new risk to our privacy and security, our cell phone numbers. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
When it comes to protecting our privacy, it seems we just can't get ahead. The latest threat, our cell phone numbers. Stephen Petro, Digital Live columnist of USA Today, is here to tell us why we're sharing our numbers too frequently. Stephen, who wants our cell phone numbers?
Well, it seems that there are an awful lot of bad guys out there who are hacking into various databases, and they are taking millions and millions of our phone numbers and doing really nefarious things with them. So when you read about those big breaches like Yahoo, Anthem, Walgreens, believe it, your cell phone numbers are part of the data that's being taken, and you are now vulnerable.
How are they using a cell phone to get to other information?
Well, it becomes part of how they collect information about you. So it used to be that your Social Security number was really the gateway to your personal identity. And from that, you could sort of find out your employment history, your health history, so on and so forth. Now, because our cell phone numbers are attached to all of that data and their privacy is not regulated, these bad guys can really go and just harvest almost any piece of information about you that's out there in the world. And you might not even know what's out there. So that's what makes it even sort of doubly scary.
Stephen, why are we not protecting our numbers closely?
Well, I think this is a good example of the law and regulations not staying ahead of technology and science. So a lot of the sources that I talked to for this piece said it's coming, but we haven't gotten there yet. And so, you know, just for instance, in the last year alone, the number of identity thefts based on cell phone numbers has more than doubled. and that trend is looking to continue for this year. So, yeah, those folks in Washington and our state capitals need to get on this.
We're speaking with Stephen Petro, digital live columnist of USA Today. Stephen, what do you do when you're at a store or you're buying something and they say, can I have your cell phone number?
Yes, so when I first heard about this, and I'll increase everybody's vocabulary by one word. So I think most of us know the phrase phishing, P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, which was when scammers would come in through email and collect data about you. So now the new term is smishing, which is SMS for texting. And so what happens is when you're in a store, one of the first questions they often ask you is, like, what's your cell phone number? And it's for your convenience on the one hand, because then when they pull up your record the next time, you just tell them your cell phone number, and you may get, you may get reward points or benefits, and, you know, that's great. But once you've given it up, it's in that database, and again, if it gets hacked, then you're vulnerable. So, you know, what I learned is you can often say, I decline. And then they may pull up your account by your name or your zip code or even your email, which identifies you less. So try declining and try providing alternatives, because that is really a necessary first step for your own protection.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with USA Today tech writer Stephen Petro. I often, as a default, give a combination of my home and cell phone number. So I've actually memorized a fake number that I put down on some of these things. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Glad you're with us. There's a booze battle in Maine, and it's over those mini bottles you'd find typically on an airplane or in a hotel bar. Apparently, enough empties on the side of the road has caused an uproar. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz. Jennifer, I always think of these things on planes.
These have become very popular on land as well, and really popular in Maine. Sales have taken off, particularly Fireball whiskey, cinnamon whiskey. Anyway, so this has led to a new problem, which is mini bottle litter. Lots of these little bottles on the roadsides, so forth. So people have become upset about that, and earlier this year, the legislature decided that they wanted to put a deposit on these little bottles to inspire people to return them rather than toss them out the window or whatever they were doing. So they wanted to put a – they passed a law that would put a 5-cent deposit on it. The governor of Maine saw this as sort of a anti-business tax, didn't like it, said, you know, if you do that, I'm just going to ban them altogether. And that's what he has moved to do. So that's where they are. They're actually, the state is actually looking at stopping sales in Maine of mini booze bottles.
Wow. And is it because of the litter that this all began? The roadside litter?
Yeah, that was the impetus for this. There were just enough people that were complaining about the litter, and legislators were hearing from constituents, and people were collecting bags of them. When they held a hearing at the state house, in fact, one legislator came in with she had found enough that she was able to like make a necklace out of them, and she had a bag of 40 of them. And then another woman had gone on a she's a scientist. She'd been on a 8-mile bike ride and had mapped how many she'd found very diligently. You know, that she'd found 9.4 mini liquor bottles per mile, and wow. Versus a far fewer number of milk containers and so forth. So, yeah, there were a lot of complaints about this. I mean, other people say, well, you know, don't pick on these little bottles, because you can also find all kinds of things, other things out on the ground too.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz out of the Boston Bureau. Her piece is called Last Call for Mini Bottles, A Little Booze Battle is Nipping at Maine. So have liquor stores, distributors, or booze makers weighed in on this at all?
Yes. The National Trade Group for Distilled Spirits doesn't like it. They're not happy. In addition, the maker of the Fireball Cinnamon Whiskey has weighed in, saying he'd rather have the deposit than the ban. So there is opposition to this, but we'll see what happens. They meet on July 11th. Maine is one of 17 states that directly controls what liquor is sold in the state, so rather than somebody private selling. Maine sells it wholesale to retail establishments. So they have a lot of power over what gets sold in Maine. It doesn't mean that you can't sneak a mini, or carry in a mini liquor bottle in your bag if you visit Maine.
Right.
But you're not going to be able to buy it there.
Thanks, Jennifer. Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz, who's based out of the Bureau in Boston. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, is part of a wave of seaside communities that are giving the thumbs down to tents on the beach. They're embracing umbrella-only policies. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, enacted such a law 4 years ago. This summer, Sunset Beach, North Carolina, and Seaside Heights, New Jersey, both rolled out such rules. Since the end of May, the Rehoboth Beach Patrol says lifeguards have blown the whistle on canopies and tents about 840 times. Lifeguards can call police if a violator does not comply. Police say they've probably written only about 3 tickets for violations at about $25 a pop. Rehoboth Beach officials say public safety and aesthetics drove the change. Large tents, also called non-traditional shading devices, make it harder for lifeguards to see the beach and water while impeding access to the ocean. Some people use the walls to hide smoking or boozing. Officials say umbrellas pose less of a navigational challenge for lifeguards and first responders than, say, canopies or tents that might have multiple poles and, in some cases, tethers. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Hey, thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more from This Morning Show, check us out at thismorningwithgordondeal.com.